Hi, everybody. Welcome to the fourth episode in Innovative Methods in Criminology. I'm Ian Brennan from the University of Hull, and I'm joined today by our guest, Rica Salamosi. Rica is a lecturer in quantitative methods at the University of Manchester. Rica, very welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me, and thank you for people listening. My name is Rica. I am a senior lecturer at the University of Manchester, based in the Department of Criminology, but my title is a lecturer in quantitative methods. I think that was more the stare of who they were trying to recruit for the job than anything to do with me. But it does mean that I end up teaching all the stats modules. So as you can guess, I am everybody's favorite.
Yes, it must make you popular.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I am the cool nerd. So before coming to Manchester, I was briefly a crime analyst working for Transport for London, and then working with closely with the Met Police, looking at all the ways that you can, I don't know, be a victim of crime or die or be seriously injured while traveling on the on London Transport, which, you know, thankfully is very rare. So very, very safe, but it was a really neat experience, as grim as it sounds, analyzing the data there, because the results of the analysis obviously went into making changes to prevent these grim things from happening to more people. So that was really nice.
How did you get into being a crime analyst in the first place?
So I did my PhD at UCL. And I did it in the crime science PhD program, which their whole thing was being interdisciplinary. So I actually came from a very much a social science background. So before that, my undergrad was in sociology, but I focused a lot on research methods. So hence the quantitative angle, a lot of survey research and so on. And then after that, I did a criminology master's actually here at Manchester. So, but when I got there, you know, it was supposed to be all interdisciplinary. And one of my supervisors was actually based in civil engineering, and he was a professor of transport studies. And so I got into sort of transport analytics, and then at the same time, crime analytics. I got really into R and coding. And so when this job came up at Transport for London for a crime analyst, I was like, what? This is perfect for me. So I applied and got into that.
Very good. So had you planned to leave academia, or is it just a convenient job?
Oh, I did. After my PhD, I was like, academia is the worst. Why would anyone be an academic? Then I went into, you know, the real world. I don't like when people say that, but I just did. And then somehow, you know, the pull was too strong. It couldn't stay away, and ended up back in academia. But yes, originally I was like, I want to do something that has very direct application, and I want to see sort of immediate feedback. Because with a PhD, you think so long about something and you work so long on this project, right? You've got 3 years to work on one thing. And by the end of it, you kind of think, well, what is the point? No one's going to read this. It'll never make any changes. And I was very disheartened. But since then, since coming back to academia, I've tried to balance and do a lot more applied work, or work with practitioners, work with police, to try and make sure that what I do does eventually have some application, to try and keep that thread alive.
Excellent. Very good. And you're in a really strong department in terms of methodology as well. So, the list of people who plan to interview from this podcast is about 50% University of Manchester. Some really amazing stuff going on there. I don't know what's going on with that department, but it must be amazing to work there.
Oh, no, it's fantastic. So when the reason I applied is, at the time, Professor Juanjo Medina was here, and he was very much starting to build the sort of criminological capacity in learning and using R for research and reproducible research, and, you know, thinking about quantitative methods in kind of meaningful, more meaningful ways than just, this is your chi-square, this is when you use it. And so I think he had like a little mission, and he also recruited David Bulgill for PhD, who's now, again, one of our colleagues. I hope we're getting this momentum, and we've got really great people at the minute. So I'm very lucky in that sense, get lots of good ideas and then get to bounce it off people, which is really nice.
Nice. Can you tell us a little bit about your PhD, which just seems to be the starting point for what I wanted to talk to you about today? So just give us a bit of flavor of the PhD and the reasons you chose that topic to start with.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was really interested in, as I said, I kind of was dropped into this environment of transport and crime on transport and people's experience on transport. You know, I also had just first moved to London, and London transport network is very cool. It's very sort of international, like me. You know, you see the roundel and you're like, wow, that's a cool thing. So I was really interested in people's experiences while traveling. And unfortunately, sometimes part of that experience could be, you know, victimization or fear of victimization or experiencing something that just makes you feel unsafe, unhappy, and so on. And so I started getting interested in sort of fear of crime and people's perceptions of safety. That's a topic that is quite interesting for transport for, providers, for example, because if people are worried about being a victim of crime on public transport, they will likely avoid it. And, you know, that's from a transport provider perspective, that's bad because it's lost revenue. But from a sustainability perspective, for example, that's bad because people will take a car and pollute the environment. And from an equality perspective, it's bad as well because certain groups of people are more likely to experience fear and worry. But they also might be more likely to be reliant on public transport options. So Marty Smith has this concept of the transit captives, who are people who have horrible experiences taking public transport, but have to do it for their work and because of their socioeconomic status. So anyway, I started reading about this and I thought, okay, well, let's look at how this is approached, how this is measured. And it turns out that, I mean, anyone who's studied fear of crime knows that this concept is basically meaningless. About once a decade, there's a paper that says, this is the worst term, it doesn't mean anything, let's never use it, right? So you have the Ferraro-Lagrange paper from the 80s, and then you've got John Bannister and team from the 90s, and sort of every so often somebody says, this is garbage. And then I think at the time when I was reading, the most recent innovation was the work of John Jackson, Emily Gray, where they were looking at the frequency and intensity measures. And I was like, oh, I guess, you know, this is solved for surveys. This is how we measure incidence-based fear of crime. But then I was trying to reconcile that with the experience that people have when they're generally out and about doing their thing, traveling around. And it still didn't seem to match, because what a survey mostly will capture is people's general attitudes and worries and fear. And even if it's sort of that intensity and frequency based, it's still reflecting on, well, you know, if you ask me, how worried am I? How often did I worry? You know what, that time, yeah, I was pretty worried. I think about who I am as a person, right? Things like age, gender, how often I travel, where I travel. And I start to generalize. And it's really hard to translate that into something that's a specific experience. Because most people, most of the time, traveling on transport, they don't care about crime, right? You're like, I want to get from A to B. This tube is really crowded. That guy's eating a really stinky chicken and chips. Like, these are your main concerns. But sometimes something happens, and then all of a sudden, that's the situation. And that's what I wanted to look into capturing, because that's what I thought could be the, I guess, building block and conceptualization and operationalization of the kind of fear of crime experiences that something like a situational intervention could do something about, right? That's something that maybe we could address easier than the general anxieties and worries that people have in their heads.
Of course, this has challenges in terms of measurement, because like the level of dimensions that a survey item that asked about different times of day or different situations would mean like a victimization survey would be 90% fear of crime questions. So what were the typical methods that were being used to measure fear of crime when you started, and what were their assumptions and weaknesses?
Yeah, so like you said, if we wanted to implement this level of nuance into survey item, it would be an impossibly long survey. And, you know, very expensive and so on. And it would still have a couple of problems that wouldn't be solved. One is it still relies on recall, right? So people still have to think back and say, okay, well, this is what I think happened, or this is the last time this happened, or something like this. And there's all sorts of biases associated with recall, like recency bias and all these different issues. So that's one problem. The other problem was the location and time. So time can be related to people don't remember when it was. But location, the way that location is usually measured in this is the respondent's home address. Right? If we're lucky, it also asks for their work address. But that doesn't tell us where the worry experience happens. It tells us where worried people live or where worried people work. And so these, again, didn't tap into what I was envisioning to see is where are these locations of worry. And there had been some work trying to map this. So I remember my first international conference was the ESC, actually in Budapest. And, you know, they have those stalls of books. And I went to the stalls of books and I picked up one and the title was Putting Fear of Crime on the Map. And I was like, whoops. Oh, there's my thesis.
Yeah, gazumped.
Yeah, I hope my supervisor hasn't seen this. I'd like to buy all the copies, please. It turned out it was this the study in Australia where they were asking people to carry a cognitive mapping of places where they were worried. A lot of it was places where people would avoid because of the high crime or high perceived crime in those areas. So it was slightly different, but there had been, you know, these attempts where still using this kind of retrospective approach, but trying to, you know, put fear of crime on the map and get these locations. But this looked to me, and luckily to my supervisors and examiners at the time, is a problem that hasn't yet been solved.
Could you just describe how they would do that cognitive mapping? So, how they'd collect that data from people?
So I think this study used participatory mapping as well, but there were a few other ones that use basically participatory mapping or participatory GIS, sometimes it's called, where you present users with a map of an area that they know. And you say, indicate to me on here whatever it is that you want them to map. So in this case, it was places you avoid walking through in the night or in the day, or places where you feel unsafe if you have to walk through that. And then they collect responses. And from that, they could make, for example, a heat map or something like this.
So they're sort of sitting in not a laboratory, but they're in a sort of research or data collection setting. So they're not out on the street walking around with participants or anything like that.
Not in, as far as I recall, not in that. It's been a long time since I read that book, but I don't think that they do that in that book. I know that there's other studies. So there's the kind of famous Fisher and Nassar studies where they look at the prospect refuge, is it concealment elements of a fear of crime, where there's a specific route that participants have to walk through campus, and then they walk with them and they take notes and they have to narrate their experience. So there's that kind of approach. And then more recently, there's online mapping approaches. So Andrea Puder and her colleague had a paper where they have an online map, and then they ask people to draw polygons around areas where they feel safe or unsafe. And then again, aggregate the responses and create a grid of safety or unsafety. But generally, these still ask people their opinion or to reflect on something. So that was the one thing that I felt was missing.
And how did you go about dealing with that?
So I was looking at other methods and methods that tap into people's routine everyday activities and everyday life. And then I came across experience sampling method. So the sort of original work of Mihai Csikszentmihalyi and I remember that one name because it's Hungarian. And then, Suzanne Prescott as well. So they asked people, they were looking at mental health, I believe, or like practices around mental well-being. And they asked people, this was before, smartphone technology. So they would have a written paper diary or a questionnaire survey and a pager. And they asked people to carry the pager and the questionnaire or a diary. And then based on the protocol that they developed, they would beep them I don't know, some number of times a day. And each time that the participant was beeped, they would have to answer the questions. And what this approach helped tap into was people's everyday activities or everyday experiences or feelings or thoughts as they were experiencing them. So without having to, you know, think back at the end of the day, oh, these are the things that happened, or think back 12 months or 3 months or however long. So this experience sampling methodology to me was something that, okay, well, this taps into the experiences of people as and when they're actually there in the right context, in the right place, in the right time. And it's to me, like a true measure of frequency and intensity, because, you know, it'll reflect exactly, you know, as we're tracking people, how often they experience this and what it is, the this that they experience in this time. So I was looking at that. Sorry.
Is that what we would call ecological momentary analysis, or is that something slightly different?
I think, and I don't know if this is a controversial thing to say, but I think they're the same thing. So I've seen papers that are ecological momentary assessment, experience sampling. I think ecological, they come from slightly different origins. ESM is from psychology, and I think ecological momentary assessment is from medicine. Is that right? So I think that came a little bit later. There are people who say there's some differences, but to me, I haven't been convinced that the differences are substantial enough that I would separate them. But, you know, other people might argue differently, and I'm happy to be convinced otherwise. But a short answer from me would be, yes, that's essentially, from my understanding, pretty much the same thing.
They sound close enough, at least. Yeah. So they were using pagers and pen and paper. When the, what, the 90s, 80s, 90s?
Oh, I think it's 80s, but I'm terrible with this.
So we've got sort of technology now that can replace pagers. So I think I see where the next advance in this technology is coming.
Yes. Yeah, so pagers, quite extinct by the time I was at UCL. On the other hand, smartphones were happening. In fact, I think of my starting cohort, because we were kind of in cohorts in that training program, I was the only one with a flip phone. everyone else is like, ooh, iPhones and Androids and whatever. So it made sense for me to go for a project that uses a smartphone so I can have a reason to upgrade, right? So there was a really well-known app at the time, which was actually, it was coming out of London. It was called Mappiness by George McCarron, was the lead researcher on that, I think. And it was, I think, an iPhone app, and it implemented this experience sampling approach to measure happiness. So it pinged people, I don't know, I think you could select how many times a day and ask people, I think it was like a sliding scale of smileys of how happy they are. And then it asked a couple of other questions, if they're with someone, what they're doing, if they want to take a photo. And it made use of the sensors in the smartphone for getting a timestamp and getting a GPS coordinate location. And so what that resulted in, it was very, very popular. So firstly, it resulted in so much data without having to go to people, give them a pager, give them a diary. Please don't leave this at home. Please use it for a week. I will, I don't know, pay you some Amazon voucher or however it is that participants are incentivized. And so because they didn't have to do that, I think they had like 200,000 participants or something ridiculous and lots of data. So that looked very attractive as a PhD student saying, how can I get some data? And just the idea of the additional information, right? One of the main themes with fear of crime and surveys is that people can't remember things, people lie, people forget things, you get bad answers. So the more of the data collection you can automate, so instead of asking, hey, where were you when this happened? Getting the phone to get some GPS coordinates, it seemed really, really attractive.
Is the Mappiness data, was it available to you as a researcher to look at?
At the time when I looked, I don't think that it was. But this was pre sort of the big boom for open science and open data. So I wonder if it is since. The quick answer is I'm not sure if it is at the moment.
Okay. Were there any other, because I hadn't heard of Mappiness, but I've heard of other types of safety apps or like safety measurement apps that have been around. Is it Safer Streets? There's a sort of gender-based violent or VOG-based one as well.
Yeah, those are a bit newer though, right?
I think so. I mean, they've come across my consciousness in the last year or so, but I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how long they've been around.
Yeah, so I've also seen them in the past couple of years because they have been, I've seen them popping up in a lot of these violence against women and girls strategies. I remember after I finished my PhD, also there was a girl who asked to have a meeting because she was rolling out something that was very similar to, so again, for people to report where they feel safe and unsafe. And she was aiming it at women. And I think she was calling it like Safe and the City or something like this. And I think she started working with the Met Police a little bit, but I don't know if it ever took off. But we had conversations because of my research and these implementations. I feel, and there was one actually before I give my opinions. There's one that was using Airbnb location, and I think they wanted to integrate with Airbnb because they also reached out. So it was wanting to create a safety map that you could integrate with your Airbnb map so you can find out how safe it is, the area where you're gonna. And I think if we had good solid data, and I'll talk about strength and limitations of this method. But of course, one limitation is the bias of the data that it is able to collect. So if we had good sampling approaches and good representativeness and good generalizability, then these sound great. But I, at the minute, and what I said to the person that I met with is, I think it could be quite misleading to use this in that kind of setting of safety mapping, because you know, safety is super subjective, and mapping an area as unsafe can have quite serious consequences of people avoiding it, not going there. Then let's say it is a little bit unsafe, but now it becomes more unsafe because you lose that sort of natural surveillance, that capable guardianship in the area. So to have this as something presented back to the public without the filter of, hey, how good is this data? Whose views are we representing? I feel very uncomfortable about. But as a data collection tool to better understand potential hotspots for unsafety, taken with that grain of salt and with that methodological understanding of what these data can and cannot tell you, what they do and do not represent, I think it could be super duper useful, yes. But yeah, in terms of just crowdsourcing safety and reporting it back to the public, because, you know, this method is so new still, and especially using it to operationalize place-based fear of crime. Like, we think it works. You know, I did my study. There's been replications in many different countries, and we've come up with these maps, and we've done some evaluation, and we've done some reflection. But it's so new that, you know, like, if you think about how much study and research and questionnaire development goes into a survey questionnaire, we are still very far away from that. So, yeah, sorry, you asked if there's any other ones, and I was like, yes, but...
I was hoping to just lead it into sort of open data and what was available, and then into, you know, what your PhD sort of sought to overcome and how to the extent to which it did that. So yeah, just tell us a little bit about specifically your PhD project and what's come from that.
Sure. So there was the problem of we didn't have this place-based measure of fear of crime. So to solve that, I built a mobile application which implemented experience sampling, but specifically for fear of crime. So I took the question from the crime survey for England and Wales, which says, in the last 12 months, how worried have you been for, I don't know, crime type, but instead reworded to be, in this moment, how worried are you about becoming a victim of crime? And so you still had the four possible answers. So again, lifting, you know, the crime survey England Wales have done all the hard work of questionnaire development, of validation, of reliable, all of that testing. So I'm just, implementing that in this instrument. So if the person answered not at all or not very worried, that was it. I got the timestamp and the location with that report, and it got submitted. If they answered fairly or very worried, there were a couple of follow-up questions. So what was it that the person was worried about that made them feel worried? And that was actually the main follow-up question. There were iterations of the app for different purposes. So I did work before starting work with Transport for London. I did work with them to map fear of crime in a particular bus route. So there were bus-related questions. And I did work with the Camden LGBT Forum looking at fear of hate crime. So there were some hate crime related questions on those iterations, but that was pretty much it. Nice and simple and location specific. The one additional thing it did have is a retrospective reporting option, because unlike for, you know, happiness, which you can pretty much report whenever, if you're in a particular situation and you're worried about crime, are you feeling unsafe? Maybe, I don't know, it's late, it's really crowded, something like that, and you're worried that somebody's going to snatch your phone, you're not going to take out your phone to then tell me about that. So we had a retrospective annotation option where people could report and they could choose a location by tapping on a map where they were at the time and telling me how many hours ago the incident happened, to try and keep it as recent as possible. And then we got the location and timestamp from that, but otherwise the questions were the same.
How frequently would people be sampled?
So we did some simulations to see how to do the sampling. And we decided with a default of 4. And these were staggered through the 4 sort of transport times for the day. So morning, AM peak, intraday, PM peak, evening, right? Or 5, whatever, however many those were. So we sampled, the overnight might have been grouped. So we originally sampled from that. Now, of course, like all projects, mine went through ethics review, which is actually quite intensive for this one. And so one thing that we introduced from feedback for that is the ability to either turn off sampling or to reduce the frequency of the sampling. So actually, if somebody did that, we did get that information. So now we know what is there, the amount that we want to sample. Not too many people actually changed the sampling. I can't remember the exact figure, but it was much less than I was originally fearing. So most people got the 4 pings a day. So there's different approaches, right? So this, when you get a ping and you respond to that for experience sampling methods, it's called signal contingent protocol. So the response is contingent on this signal. But we also allowed for event contingent, which means that if somebody, we instructed participants that, okay, you're going to get pinged 4 times a day, but if something happens that you want to report, please report that as and when it happens or as close as possible. So we got some of those as well. And so that was quite interesting, because if you look at the signal contingent results, most people most of the time are not at all worried about crime. And this is something that actually, you know, we know as humans who live and experience worry about crime. Most of the time we care about other things, but there wasn't a lot of empirical evidence that actually supported that before this. So, you know, most people, most of the time, I'm fine. I'm not at all worried. Stop asking. But when they do the event-based, obviously those are something happened, right? That to make someone feel worried. So those recorded more of the fairly and very worried responses.
And how many, what was your sort of sample size? How did you go about finding people to sort of give you this information?
So for the very first pilot study, which was published in the first paper, I think we only had like 8 people or something. It was very, very small, because I wanted to conduct the qualitative follow-up as well and just evaluate. So it was a feasibility study of, does this even work? Does it reflect people's experiences? What are we measuring? For the PhD in total, I think in the end we had something like 80 participants, but they submitted like hundreds of points, so that was nice. We did see this thing called participant inequality, where some people, all 4 pings, all of the days, really conscientious, and some people submitted 1 or 2 or 3 points. So it, you know, doesn't mean that all of these people replied all of the time, but we did get pretty good amounts of data. Participant recruitment was really difficult. It was definitely the bane of my existence for a lot of my PhD. Yeah, I didn't have funding to pay people for participation, and so on. So it was definitely the points where I thought, ooh, I'm not going to get enough data. But in the end, it was all right. But I targeted mostly students in and around UCL in London, so I could have the area. I did have, so I mentioned a couple of side projects. So we did also look at fear of crime on a specific bus route in London. So then we targeted passengers on that bus, and Transport for London helped with the advertising and the promotion of the app. And then also working with the Camden LGBT Forum, I went to specific meetings and groups and said, hey, look, this is an app to report, worry about hate crime. If you do that, you know, I'm working with the Camden LGBT Forum organization. They will work with us to use this data to make changes.
So you've got this like amazing longitudinal data set across different contexts and places. And what have you used it to discover, and what are the applications of this sort of new measurement tool?
So there's lots of potential, and then there's some stuff that I've done that is nowhere near, you know, the amazing potential that we wanted to achieve. And mostly that's because the coverage, so I said, ooh, like hundreds of data points, but the coverage of where these data points are, it's quite sparse. It's they're spread pretty sparse, because, you know, students might attend one location, but London's quite big and they live in lots of places and they travel lots of different routes to those places. So the coverage was maybe not what I originally had wanted and intended. But I did, sometimes these results seem like, oh, well, no duh. But actually, there are things that maybe haven't had evidence behind them before or haven't had any data behind them. So just looking at things that, you know, most people most of the time not worried about crime, but also what happens if somebody experiences something where they are worried, right? And then you have this, like you said, longitudinal data within the person. So you see, boom, you've got an incident of worry. And then it's actually kind of a gradual, the next report is a slightly less worry, and then a slightly less worry, and then back to not worried. So you have this kind of decay of worry.
How long is that sort of residual effect last?
So I can't answer that because people weren't necessarily reporting as frequently as they were being pinged, unfortunately. Yeah, so the non-report doesn't mean that they were constantly still very worried. So unfortunately, I cannot say that. But it wasn't an immediate drop back to, ooh, that happened, that was scary, whatever, now I'm fine.
It would be, I suppose, at some point in the future, we could even link in biomeasures to look at sort of autonomic nervous system response, like heart rate and whatever next thing our smartwatches are going to start measuring.
Oh, absolutely. So a follow-up project that I did after starting at Manchester with some colleagues from Spain and Portugal was exactly that. So we filmed a scenario of what you know, from the perspective of the person, you're walking through the canals late at night, and then there's you walk through this tunnel that's full of graffiti, you know, all your fear of crime stimuli thrown at you. And then there's two events, which is a scary guy appears first at when the tunnel lights change. So you come out of the tunnel, which is lit, and then it's dark, and then boom, there's a dude there. And then later on, you walk in again, this guy appears in the canal. So what we did for that is I adapted the app a little bit, so it was only one button. And we asked people to just press this button if this is something where, if this was real life, you would feel worried for your, I think we said, personal safety. And then besides that, we also equipped them with a heart rate monitor and galvanic skin response. So galvanic skin response, also called electrodermal activity, it's basically how sweaty your palms get. The way that I entertain participants while sticking all these stickers on them is I tell them it's the same as the lie detector. So, but what it actually measures is just physiological response to something. And so we wrote up some of this in the chapter in the security handbook that I think should be out at some point. But what we had a really small sample. So this was very, again, feasibility study. I think we had 15 participants. But anecdotally, the results are, if I had to make up results, this is what I would make up. So that sounds bad. I just said that in public. It's going to be broadcast everywhere. Like, open science. But anyway, we had, you know, the young female student participant who pressed the button, I think, the maximum amount of times that it was possible. I was like, wow, I would be super worried. And looking at the physiological response, she had a peek at both of the scary men. Whereas we had big guy, a bit older, quite confident, and he didn't press the button, not even once. So actually, when he was having the debrief interview, I kind of snuck in, and at the end, I was like, was it malfunctioning? Did you not meet? He's like, no, you know, in real life, if that guy appeared, I would just put on my scary face. You know, so for him, this kind of self-response, it didn't register as a worry event at all. But when you look at the physiological response, the EDA, same peaks as the girl. So obviously there's a reaction there. It doesn't mean that this is fear of crime, right? It doesn't mean he's lying. It's not necessarily that social desirability bias or something like that. It might just mean that for him, it's not registering as I'm worried. It's registering as oh, there's something I might have to react to. Yeah. But if we go back to, you know, what is fear of crime? Why do we care about it? If it's something that means, you know what, I had an unpleasant experience and I'm not going to walk through that area again, I'll just take a cab. That's something that we should care about.
Amazing. Cool. Thinking about other sort of insights from this data set, is there anything else you want to sort of bring up?
So I think there's lots of issues with the data set, which mean that, you know, I found some cool stuff, but needs replication. But one of the really neat things was that once I published this paper, I think lots of people were probably thinking around the same topic in the same area, because all of a sudden there was a lot of replication internationally, which, you know, is really, really nice to see. It means, oh, this was a good idea. Other people also think this was a good idea. And it's nice to see that they're seeing similar results. So one thing that we did, part of the same project as the sensing one, is actually try and take stock of everyone who's been using this method in the, I don't know, since some cutoff time. So we've got this sort of review paper that looks at the strengths and the limitations of the method. And so under the strength, we cover a lot of things that people have found that this operationalization of fear of crime can actually show. So the most obvious, you know, the thing that we set out to do is capturing the spatial and temporal element of these experiences. So we get these fear of crime maps of, you know, so we have it of London, but then, you know, it's been done in Spain, in Sweden, in Australia. So it's nice to see these locations that now, you know, remember I said, oh, there was the problem of we don't have these experiences, place and time as and when they happen. So all of a sudden now we do. So that's being collected. So that's quite nice. And then the other thing is that we can now link these worry incidents with the environment that they occur in. So you can extract either from, we talked about open data, so we could look at OpenStreetMap, for example, and then just say, well, what is in the vicinity of the hotspots of worry? And we can start talking about environmental correlates of fear of crime, maybe in a way that we talk about environmental correlates of crime, right? And start looking for fear of crime patterns in the way that we start looking for crime patterns. So that's something else that's really nice. Once we place it on a map, we can start linking with other data sources.
I guess Google movement data as well then, so you can see what's the relationship between the number of people in a space at that time. The possibilities through linking all those data sets is amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's a real strength, because all of a sudden we have not where the worried people live, but where the people experience the worry, and we can start looking at, well, what's going on in those places. Yeah, like you said, Google movement, OpenStreetMap, other crowdsourced data.
So does OpenStreetMap work in the same way as Google movement? And which would be my naivety. I don't know what data goes into OpenStreetMap.
OpenStreetMap, the way that I would use it is more for features. So they would say, oh, here's a bus. So you can look at bus stops or tree. Oh, I don't know if people map trees, but they'll map like tree area or parks or, you know, schools or something like that. So you can extract, yeah, what are the features. It is crowdsourced. So it is people mapping their own areas. But in cities, and especially in Western cities, it has really, really good coverage. So it's quite reliable.
One of the things that I found really interesting when I was reading your work is where it overlaps with the work that I do around violence against women and girls, and particularly evaluating interventions. So there's been a big, like a huge amount of interest in evaluating a variety of different forms of interventions that focus on safe spaces and place-based interventions in general for reducing particularly women's feelings of fear, but also actual experience of violence. And the big challenge we constantly face is, how do you measure, what's your outcome measure for these, and how would you actually go about capturing it? Because sampling is so difficult when you're trying to intervene in a place rather than with the population. So this feels like it has got a huge potential for establishing, for baselining and evaluating the effectiveness of these interventions. Has that come across your desk yet?
So that is absolutely one of the arguments that we make of why this is really important, is because if I read like evaluations of, well, we put up CCTVs in the car park and then we measured fear of crime, and we did that by, you know, going surveys and asking people, how worried are you? Are you here? But yeah, that taps into a slightly different thing than if you had, I don't know, you can even well, you'd have to ask people to have this application, but you could say, you know, if you park in this car park, you get 10% off your parking if you download this app and then answer some questions. I don't know, something like incentive is always what I'm thinking about now. Why would people use this? But then you could get that, because it might be that one level you introduce CCTV and people feel safer, and then the other one not. And why is that? What are the differences between that? So it really taps into that experience, which is what the intervention probably is trying to address. Because if people are answering, oh, I'm worried because their sister's, you know, dog's walker was robbed when they were once at that car park, can't really do anything about that. And then especially for violence against women, I think this is really relevant because of the whole things around underreporting, right? You have really, really horrible data about things like sexual harassment, right? Very underreported. I mean, at Transport for London, you know, I worked with evaluating the Report It to Stop It campaign, which it was like lots of money, lots of time, lots of partnership working, lots of energy to try and get people to report. And it did work, but only, you know, in specific instances where this was targeted to. And so one thing that asking people to report about their experiences of worry does is it removes a couple of barriers that are associated with reporting a crime, right? So, and this came up when I was working with Camden LGBT Forum around hate crime, right? There's no need to go to the police. There's no need to think that you need to have a strong enough case to be believed. There's no, people have had experiences where they were shamed or where they were outed or something like that by the reporting experience. And when you just tell an app, I didn't feel happy, you know, something happened, that's because that's you reporting your subjective experience. There's no need to justify. So I think in that sense, it has a very good link, and that links with what I want to do next is understanding these specific fear of crime events as possible near misses with victimization. Because when I was doing the original pilot evaluation study, one thing I found is when, you know, I talked about the event contingent protocol, right? So when people say there's no ping, but they by themselves say something happened, I feel worried. A lot of those were linked to near misses with victimization. So one was, oh, somebody almost snatched my phone. One was, oh, I saw somebody trying to remove a bike that was locked. It didn't seem like they had the keys. So these notices of something that they wouldn't report as a crime, but it's possibly a near miss. And for, especially in the case of violence against women, right? So you might have catcalling, you might have whistling, you might have staring, something where people might not report it, but it's uncomfortable. And it might be that you have lots and lots of those in the location where you might have a few of the, I don't like saying more serious or more severe, but you know, you have the more rare but higher harm crimes occur. So by gathering information about these fear events, right, these possible signals, we might understand more about the locations and times where the other ones might happen. So I think there's a huge link there. I haven't done too much on, I wrote one blog post. We had someone from some media ask a question after the Sarah Everard case, and the way that they worded it, I was like, I'm annoyed, I'm going to write a blog post. but that's all the thinking I've really done about this. But absolutely, I think it fits really, really well into that framework.
Fantastic. So if somebody was interested, postgrad or early career researcher was interested in using these types of methods, either through accessing data or primary prospective data collection themselves, what advice would you have for somebody who wants to get into this area, and how would they go about doing it?
Well, so for using this method, I think the one place I would start is, this is going to sound bad, self-promotion, but the review article that we wrote, just because we do a nice summary of uses of this kind of approach to conceptualize and operationalize fear of crime. And it has a list of both the strengths. So I mentioned, like, these are the good things about this method. And that might give an idea of, well, for the research question I'm interested in, is this appropriate? Is this going to help me answer that research question? But also there's a couple of limitations, which are, you know, we always think about the limitations in terms of, can this research design answer the type of questions that you want to ask? But also because this is an emerging field, I think addressing ways or finding ways to address those biases is interesting research in itself. So, and there are people doing this already, but I think there's lots of open questions around, great, we know this works in mapping, you know, fear experiences, but we actually also know that it's very biased, you know, with if you're mapping, for example, crime, you know, you've got dots of robbery on the street segment, you know, the dots mean there is a crime and the no dot mean there's no crime. Okay, accounting for underreporting and underrecording and so on. But, you know, let's say we're dealing with burglary, very well reported. Whereas for something like this, if you have a I am safe point, that's a zero. I am unsafe point, that's a one. But if you have an absence, if you have nothing there, it's not quite the same, right? That doesn't mean there's nothing going on there. It means that we haven't possibly sampled that appropriately. So these are, I think, really interesting and important methodological questions that, if they are addressed, you know, they would really, really help drive this area and this field forward. So I would definitely point people toward exploring these, because you also want nice, reliable, robust methods to then apply. And then in terms of if they want to, if they just said, you know what, that's fine, the strengths are good enough, the biases I can deal with, I want to apply this. There's lots of, so you want to think about the tools for the data collection. So there's off the shelf options. And I have a UK data service webinar that we did with Michael Chataway that talks a lot about how to get started and how to use this method. But yeah, there's off the shelf options like EpiCollect is one. I think Michael uses, what is it called? MetaWire or something like this, MetricWire. And then the code for mine that I wrote is up on GitHub. So that's open source. Anyone can use it if they like. Yeah, I'm not an app developer, so the code is so-so, but, you know, adapt it at will if you want to create your own bespoke one. And in terms of open data, it might just be a question of looking at what's out there. So there are crowdsourcing projects. So, for example, you talked about violence against women and girls. And for example, there's the crowdsourcing project called safecity.in, which is a project based out of India, which is a crowdsourced map of instances of sexual harassment that women have experienced. And so I know their data is available on their website. And then just having a look at what is out there. My data is, I think it's hard to release this data because of the specific geographical location. So mine is not open, but it might be that other people's are.
Fantastic. Okay. Rika, it was a pleasure speaking to you. Thank you very much for coming on the podcast. We'll put some links in the show notes to, for example, your UKGS webinar, if it's available, and your GitHub site as well, so that those so-minded can download and reuse it. And so thank you very much for appearing on the show. It was a pleasure to have you.
Thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed this very much.
Excellent.